Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Thanks so much for joining us today. It is really a pleasure for me to have back Patty Nagai with us. She's a emeritus professor, retired UW Extension horticulture educator, and today we're going to be talking with her about all kinds of things. She hasn't been with us for a while, and we'll look at those winter woes, including how to protect perennials. We'll talk about selecting seeds and plants for your garden and when to start seeds inside. We'll also take your comments and questions, so I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. And Patty Nagai, welcome back. It's so good to see you again.
Thank you. It's so good to be here and to see you again. It's been a long time.
It has been a long time. And I want to tell our listeners a little bit of a story, because you were the person who inspired me many years ago to get a lime tree.
I can be very inspirational at times when it comes to plants.
Oh, my goodness. Limey has been with me for a long, long time. And it's really, you talked about your lime tree and your lemon tree and how it smelled in that.
Yes, they're very fragrant. Even when they're not flowering, they're fragrant because the leaves themselves smell like citrus.
And you had a bear's lime, so yes. I had to go get a bear's lime, too.
Yes, and I don't remember where you got it, but I remember you were so motivated and you just kept searching for one. You emailed me, where did you get it? How can I get one of these? So
well, I tell
I'm
you what.
I'm so glad you've been a good caretaker for your bear's lime, too, because I have enjoyed listening to you talk about limey on the radio for all these years.
Yeah, dozens and dozens of limes. It's a real, real pleasure. And I always think about you every time I walk by Limey. Limey, you wouldn't be here if it wasn't for Patty.
That's right. Because I convinced you could do it. But, you know, it is possible to grow citrus in Wisconsin. It can happen.
It is indeed. Mm-hmm. Well, what have you been up to?
Oh, my gosh. I've been incredibly busy. I've still done some things with the Master Gardener Volunteers off and on. I taught the class last year for Milwaukee when they were in a transitional mode. I helped with that. And I work part-time at a local family-owned greenhouse in Menominee Falls. And it really is a love project for me because as a horticulturist and as a former extension educator, you know that you never stop learning, right? You know, there are always more things to learn. And I think in this particular field, it's always apparent that the more you know, the more you realize you don't know. Mm-hmm. And there are always things changing and new things coming on the market and research that's being done. So it's been a great learning experience. And then I've been taking care of my family because I have three great kids who don't drive.
I know all about that.
I'm a professional chauffeur now. That's my real job.
I know all about that. You know, as you were talking, I was thinking I had a conversation with somebody about UW Extension and County Extension and the impact. Obviously, while they're working, I have a big impact. But even after retiring, so many of them, most of them get involved in community projects, get involved in community activities. I know some of them wind up a mayor of a town or...
That won't be me, but okay. I'm all for it.
I tell you what, you look at the impact, you know, agents in all those counties and they retire often in those counties and wind up doing a whole lot of good.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's not what we're supposed to talk about.
No, we're supposed to be talking about winter and gardening. And, you know, it might be January and it might be snowing and very cold, but I guarantee you your plants are still alive out there and...
Well, it can still have an effect on the garden.
Absolutely.
What you know, here we've got these fluctuating temperatures.
That's the worst. It really is.
Yeah, what kinds of problems does that cause?
It causes a lot of problems, both at the upper part of the plant as well as in the lower part of the plant. When we're talking about perennials that die back and we just want their root systems to survive in the crown so that they can come back in the spring, you know, what we're looking for is continuous frozen soil in that top layer, but have the lower portion of the soil be a bit warmer. And when we don't have snow cover, because of course snow cover is our blanket, that's our our thermal protector for root systems, then you get those fluctuating temperatures actually affect the top layers of soil where those roots can push themselves out of the ground.
Yeah.
And it becomes more of a problem, I think, with plants that are close to their zone limitations, and even more so with plants that are newly planted. So I generally recommend that when people put in new perennials or new shrubs, new trees, that, you know, they make sure that they mulch those really well and even consider doing a winter mulch, an additional winter mulch, if they remember. And that's where calendars come in handy. You know, put a reminder in your phone that, you know, sometime after Christmas, hopefully the ground is frozen by then. If we don't have snow cover, it would be really important to put in a winter mulch to help protect those newly planted things from.
But you don't want to put them in right away early in the fall.
No, because that
the
just,
Mr. Mouse or
that just creates a wonderful habitat for all of those rodents who are looking for a great place to spend the winter. And, oh my, you've given them a nice warm house as well as food for them to eat.
Yeah.
So a lot of times when people mulch too soon, they end up with a lot of rodent damage, not just on perennials but on woody plants as well, because the rodents will, of course, eat the bark.
I had someone call the show. They had a driveway that was, about 400 feet, and so they had planted shrubs of some sort on lining both sides of the, and then they mulched them really well.
All the way up to the stems, right?
And they were, they lost every single one of them in the winter.
They had some probably happy little voles and rabbits and things out there. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Well, by the way, you can join in 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Pam emailed, and she's got a question that relates to what I wanted to ask you about, too, that those unplanted bulbs, she still has some. Is it too late? Can she plant them? Can she wait till spring, or should she do it now?
She should do it now.
Yeah.
And if you cannot dig in the soil, you might find. It was interesting. So a week ago, I planted bulbs.
There you are.
I did. I found that in my yard, now I live in Menominee Falls, and so I'm a kind of a solid zone 5 area.
Yeah.
But I found in my yard that there were areas that were completely thawed and areas that were frozen to the
solid
point that I couldn't really easily dig, so I didn't. So my bulbs got planted where I could dig, which is not usually what you would want to do for garden design, but you know, sometimes you just do what you have to do.
But you put them in? And
I got them in, and I covered them, and I put a little bit of mulch on top of them, and they'll be fine. I have others that I didn't get in the ground that, so your second alternative is to get a large pot, some fresh potting soil, and you can plant bulbs in layers in a big pot. So tulips and daffodils, you know, 8 to 10 inches deep, and then you can layer them coming up. So you can actually put a lot of bulbs in a pot.
Yeah.
And then on the top 3 inches or so, you can put those minor bulbs, the iris reticulata, the crocus, the winter aconite, you know, any of those, grape hyacinths, those smaller bulbs that don't have to be planted so deep. Water them thoroughly, and then put them in like your garage.
Yeah.
So you want a little bit of winter protection from them. You don't want them to be completely subjected to that freeze-thaw that they would experience outside. But a lot of times just putting them into an unheated garage gives them the cold they need.
Yeah.
Because they need cold. And the bigger the bulb, the more cold they need. So if you're looking at a big hyacinth or a tulip or a daffodil, they might need 10 to 12 weeks of cold weather in order to flower, and the little ones don't need quite as much. But then you leave them in there for a few months. They bring them back out. I usually bring them out in like March, end of March.
Yeah.
And just let them start doing their thing. And I can get beautiful blooms in a container that way. So, and it's a way to salvage your bulbs. If you hold on to those bulbs until spring, there's not going to be anything left of them because they're living entities. They're still respiring. They're still using up carbohydrates. They're just not growing. And so by spring, they'll just be a shell. There won't be anything left.
The shell of their former selves.
Yes.
You know what I do, too, when I've done that in my garage? Typically, I'll put the pot on a board or something.
Oh, to keep it up off the floor.
Keep it up off the floor, and then the temperature from the floor is more constant.
Right. And I tend to put those kind of things that I'm attempting to overwinter in my garage. I put them up against an interior wall of my garage as opposed to an exterior wall.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense as well. You know what? Every one of our lines is full.
Oh, my gosh. I wasn't paying attention.
Let's go to Thomas in Manitowoc. Hi, Thomas.
Good morning. I wanted to ask you, I've got a few hundred lavender plants. And
that's a lot.
I've got, really good soil, and I mulched them in last fall.
Okay.
And what usually happens the last few years is that we get conditions like we have now in January where we get a slushy, wet snow on top of there, and it seems like they get glazed over and it freezes and then they end up dying.
Oh.
Is there any kind of remedy? Now, you recommended a winter mulch. How much, if I would put straw on top of those now, and
is that snow crusted now?
I was just going to say, you're up in Manitowoc. You must already have a good layer of snow up there.
We have maybe 8 inches on the ground, but it's been raining now, so it's turning into slush, and that is usually a death sentence for my lavender.
Yeah,
and
they're
kind of
subjected to all of those lovely rots that come in once that slush melts and left at that. So there are probably a couple things you could try. I mean, one of the things that I do with my lavender, I don't have 100 plants, I probably have a dozen though, is I don't cut them back. It's one of the plants that I leave standing over the winter, and I have a light mulch on them. I have not done a winter mulch, but mine are probably in a little bit more protected area than yours. I think it might be something that could benefit from a lightweight mulch, but it might not be even have to be as heavy as straw. You might consider something like evergreen boughs or coarse wood mulch of some kind. The straw might be okay too, but I'm afraid that
I like
it
the
could
evergreen
pack
boughs
down as well. So the evergreen boughs actually make a really nice protective mulch for a lot of plants like that. Did you cut your plants back?
No, I left them.
You left them standing.
Left them up, and good. I was just wondering how much mulch you could put around them without suffocating them.
Oh, at this time of year, you can completely cover the crowns. I mean, you could cover them 10 to 12 inches of winter mulch, and that would be okay. You just need to remember to pull that back off once spring gets here.
Yeah, and so like for next year,
right,
run around the neighborhood and grab up all those Christmas trees that you can.
Yeah. Instead of, it's a wonderful recycle of Christmas trees. I know in our neighborhood, they all get picked up and chipped and put into the compost pile, so they don't go into the landfill or anything. But in a lot of areas, I think they do end up in somewhere they shouldn't. And there are a lot of good uses for those Christmas tree boughs. You can certainly
use them
for winter mulch.
They're perfect.
So, if you have a local greenhouse that sells boughs and sells Christmas trees, I'm sure it's too late now, but right after Christmas, in that week between Christmas and New Year's and that first week of January, greenhouses will sell their remaining boughs and Christmas trees very cheaply.
Or maybe
they might just give them to you if you come and haul them away. So there are lots of sources for those types of winter boughs in earlier January. But now it's probably you're not going to be able to find any.
Yeah.
And I would say that straw might be an okay thing. Just don't pack it down. Make sure it stays kind of loose.
Thomas, thank you so much, and good luck.
Yeah, good luck. I admire people who grow hundreds of lavender plants. It's such a beautiful sight when they're blooming.
Oh.
Those lavender plants planted in mass are just amazing.
Yeah, my daughter Emily painted a picture for her mother of a farm with lavender plants, and it's a beautiful. It was just
gorgeous. It's one of my favorite colors for the garden.
Thanks again, Thomas. Our guest today is Patty Nagai, Emeritus Professor, retired UW Extension Horticulture Educator. I'm Larry Mueller. Tyler Ditter, our engineer today, Jill Nadeau, our producer, and you are listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your garden at midwinter today with our guest, Patty Nagai, retired UW Extension Horticulture Educator. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us for this edition of Garden Talk. I'm having a lot of fun. I hope you are as well. And lots of callers online. There is one open line at 800-642-1234. But let's take a call from Eric and Eau Claire. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Larry and Patty. I'm excited to talk to you because I'm part of the Lime Tree Club.
Good for you.
Excellent. So I actually didn't know there was a club, though. I feel
well, we're in it.
Okay,
we're the founding members.
Oh, good, good. I'm so glad.
So my wife and I were in Mexico enjoying mojitos, and I had a lot of time on the beach. And I'm like, I should make a mojito machine. It would be a lime tree with mint at the base. You could set a bottle of rum at the base of it, and it would just produce drinks all winter long when I'm not in Mexico.
You could totally do that.
Right. So my fifth year anniversary, my wife had that sitting in the living room when I came home. So I've had a lime tree now for 7 years. The mint's overgrown and died back, but now we've moved a couple of times, and it doesn't produce the way that it did when we first got it. We've done some light fertilizer, and we watered it, and we've kept it alive this long, but now we just moved to a new house with big southern exposure windows.
Perfect.
And what we found, though, is that it'll blossom, but most of the flowers will either fall off, or we'll get these tiny little seed limes, and then they'll fall off after like a week. How do we take care of it so that we get more production?
Yeah. So when was the last time you repotted it?
Years ago. Probably okay. 3, 4.
So it might be time to replenish the soil. You know, one of the things I've found with my citrus, you know, because of course it is Wisconsin, and they stay in containers all the time, and they get moved in and out, and they have probably a stressful life, and we try to make it as less stressful as possible. But what I have found is that they really appreciate fresh soil every now and then. It doesn't mean they need to be in a bigger pot, but you might find that when you take it out of the pot that the roots are completely filled in that container. And if so, pick a slightly larger container. Don't go to anything really big. You know, usually we recommend that if it's in a 10-inch pot, you go to that next size up, which would be a 12-inch pot. So it's 1 inch around that gives it a little bit more space. But lime trees don't get quite as big as some of the other citrus, so they don't need to be in a huge container. But it really does help to refresh their potting medium. And when you do that, consider incorporating a slow-release fertilizer of some sort. There are organic versions as well as synthetic versions that all have great merits and will provide that slow release of nutrients for probably 3 to 6 months. But in addition to that, fertilization is really important to maintain that healthy foliage as well as the flowering. And lime trees, citrus, are different from a lot of other plants in that they will bloom year-round. So they will bloom when they have fruit on them. They will have fruit at all different stages of development. So it's not like an apple tree where they bloom in the spring and you get little baby fruit and then in the fall you harvest them. They're not like that. They will bloom and produce fruit theoretically year round. So they really do require a high level of fertility. And they do require a lot of light. So if you're taking care of those things and it has good soil and you're really fertilizing it on a regular basis and following the instructions on whichever fertilizer you choose, then light is very important, making sure that it's in a very bright light. If you think that it's not getting enough light, if it looks like it's yellowing out or dropping leaves, you might consider adding some sort of plant light to it. Doesn't have to be anything fancy.
I use a pole lamp.
They have some, pole lamp will work. You know, they've got some really nice LED plant lights now.
Yeah, LEDs and a pole lamp.
They're really cool. So, yeah, there are lots of options there. Then the reason a lot of times that they drop their flowers or they drop their immature fruit, sometimes they drop their immature fruit because it's not pollinated. And in the break, Larry and I were talking about pollinating. how to pollinate the flowers, because even though they are mostly perfect flowers with male and female parts, sometimes they need a little help getting that pollen over to the female stigmatic surface. So you could help with that. But usually when they drop fruit and drop flowers, it's because of uneven watering. So too dry, too wet, too dry, too wet. Or drafts, like a cold air draft or a hot air draft, something that is causing some temperature fluctuations, that can cause the fruit to drop as well. So do any of those things apply to you, do you think?
We got the light now, but we definitely were struggling with that a little bit. And inconsistent watering, a young kid, so I'm sure, you know, we haven't been as diligent as we had before we had the, you know, our son.
Right, right.
So I think, you know, and the amount of fertilizer that we've done is probably once a year application. So,
oh, that's not enough.
No.
That's not enough.
Yeah.
I fertilize every time I water.
I think we found your challenge right there. So I would go, you know, Larry uses a fish emulsion fertilizer, which is a really great idea. It's very dilute. There is a recommendation on the packaging for fish emulsion for how much you use if you're going to use it every time you water. I use a synthetic fertilizer that has a lot of micronutrients in it. So it provides iron and magnesium, which can be depleted for citrus. And there are a lot of things that are required for the
plant
to grow.
Which one do you use?
Do you want me to tell the brand?
Sure, go ahead.
I use Jax.
Oh.
And I alternate between their Bloom Booster and their Houseplant Special. So it is a highly dissolvable, easy-to-use kind of a fertilizer, and they'll have the rates on there for different things. And I do switch up. I don't use the same one all the time. So, because you get different nutrient ratios in the different types of fertilizers. And I've had really good success with that.
And how often do you fertilize?
I don't fertilize every time I water, but I probably fertilize about once every 2 weeks.
Yeah, every other time.
If I remember. And then at least once every month, you know, if I think, oh my gosh, I didn't fertilize. But I water my citrus a lot. Now, my lime doesn't get as much water as my lemons, but my lemon trees are bigger. But those lemons get watered about once every 5 days.
My lime tree gets once a week.
Yeah, and the lime is about once every 10 days. I don't water it as frequently as I do, but it's a smaller plant.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Eric, does that help?
Yes, I'll be raising my mojito glass and cheers to you both when I have new limes growing. Thank you.
Okay, let me know when you figure out how to produce the rum. That's the thing. I know how to do the limes and the mint. I'm good with that.
You know, I actually have a bottle of rum that's about 5 paces away from limey.
Oh, it's perfect. Maybe if you put it closer, it would cause the plant to flower and fruit more because it would see its favorite partner.
Oh, man. Eric, thanks again. Lots of fun talking to you. Jean in Platteville. Hi.
Hi. Good morning.
Morning.
I have a question. I gathered some milkweed seeds. I actually have a pod with the fluffy seeds.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if I can plant them in the spring or put them in a pot to start them and then put them in the ground, or did I miss a window and I should have just tossed them on the ground when I plucked the pot off?
Probably.
I'm trying to think if they have a, you know, I know that they do have a dormancy, but I think it's a pretty simple one. Normally what's recommended for milkweed is to just let them do their thing outside, which is generally an indication that it's a simple dormancy that just requires a little bit of cool, damp, warm, cool, damp, you know, kind of that fluctuating temperature and moisture situation. But what you could try, now they might have been, if you've had them in your house, they might have desiccated a little bit, and so they may not have good viability, but it's worth trying. You could take them and I would say take a, you could either do it in a plastic bag or you can do it in a pot. Pot would probably be easier if you're going to put it outside. Sow the seeds on top of the planting mix and then lightly cover them, maybe only a half inch of the potting soil, and water it thoroughly and then put it outside. Just put it outside,
yeah.
You know, somewhere where it can be exposed to the natural environment and the natural changes in temperature and those sorts of fluctuations. I know that on the Monarch websites, they have probably more detailed instructions on different methods for planting and growing milkweed.
Yeah, I think they do. And I can't
remember. Maybe some of the native plant sources as well. If you went to like prairie seeds or Agricole or one of those native plant suppliers, they might have some growing instructions on there that would give you some alternatives. But that would be my recommendation, is to try and mimic the natural environment as much as possible.
You know, those caterpillars that turn into monarchs, I'm sure you know this, but they, one of the reasons for feeding on the milkweed plant is that it has a toxin that the larvae don't mind, but the predators mind when the butterfly becomes a monarch.
Right.
And so they kind of provide a poison that deters other
plants and insects are amazing.
What a great relationship, isn't it?
There are so many wonderful relationships like that.
Absolutely. Jean, good luck. Thank you so much.
Good luck. I'm glad you're doing it. You know, that's a worthwhile thing to do, and to be able to provide milkweed in your yard. A lot of people aren't willing to do that because it is, of course, it's a native plant, but it's not the, you know, the most attractive plant. And it's still listed as a noxious weed in some communities.
It will take over.
And it will. It will. If it's in a happy place, it'll be really happy.
Sometimes I have to grit my teeth a little bit and pull some out of some of my beds.
But it provides such an important food source for the monarchs. So it's great to do that.
Jill in Racine has something for us. Hi, Jill. Thank you for calling.
Hi. First, quickly, can I ask, Jack's fertilizer is for which plants?
Oh, you know, I use the Jack's fertilizer for all sorts of things because they have a full line of fertilizers that are really well formulated for specific things. There's one that's specifically for petunias, which I always thought was, but it's a nice one for bedding plants, for improving bloom of annual plants. I use the houseplant special, and then I also use the blossom booster.
Okay. My question was, I'm glad somebody mentioned a tree and protecting it with pine boughs. I have a transplanted tree, and it was beautiful. It was, and I think I grew it from a pine cone, but I grew it from about 2 inches tall.
Wow.
And now it's a foot tall.
Wow, that's great.
It was beautiful. But about the top 4 or 5 inches are brown. I did prune small branches from below that, and they were green.
Hmm.
So I think it will survive, but maybe not as a tree.
No, you may have created a shrub or a bonsai pine, which is okay.
Yeah.
If the form does not offend you, and if it's still growing and you like it, I would say just, you know, prune out. If it's brown, it's dead. So prune out the dead part, but wait until spring to do that. Don't do it now. Wait until spring.
For sure.
And see what kind of new growth you're getting on it. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, we often do strange things to our trees and shrubs and put them in unusual forms or put them in places where they can't grow in their natural shape. I mean, that's a fairly common thing. Mm-hmm. And as an extension educator, I used to really scold people about doing that. But now that I'm not an extension educator, I can say, I think you should just go with it, you know, and see what happens.
Yeah.
And it's okay to experiment with plants. You can always go get another one.
When I was a little kid, my dad planted a bunch of pines and they were all dying. And so he was so disgusted. He was, you know, kind of digging them out. And my brother, who was even littler than me, had a sandbox. And he took a few of them and he just stuck them in the sandbox. And they, of course, immediately recovered and started growing.
Because they like that well-drained sand as opposed to probably the heavy clay soil that your father had implanted in.
My dad kind of shook his head at that.
That's very funny. Yes, I like that.
Thanks, Jill. Thanks for calling. Well, Chris and Adams, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Chris.
Good morning. Gardeners are just the best people. We all drink lime juice-based cocktails.
It's true.
You know, it makes really good hollandaise sauce, too. Mm-hmm. Just so you know.
Well, I usually use lemon, but now that you say that.
Yeah, try limes. Yeah, they make really good, make really good hollandaise sauce. Yeah. A couple of things. I bought a bunch of stuff on final sale at the end of the summer. And then, of course, got real bogged down in all that fun stuff like raking leaves and whatever.
Yes.
And one of the things I bought was an ever-blooming lilac bush. So I didn't get it in the ground, and I thought, well, I'm not just going to let it outside to freeze. I'll bring it in the house and see what happens because it's going to die anyway. And I've been fertilizing it and watering it, and it's blooming right now.
Oh, that's funny. Yes, you have forced it into bloom. That's really
my amaryllis are not doing anything. My orchids are not doing anything. But
your
lilac
is blooming.
That is blooming.
I can't tell you how happy that makes me.
It makes me happy, too. It smells wonderful.
Yeah.
But I thought, you know, I can just wait until spring and put it in the ground. It'll probably die then, but that's okay.
You know what?
So
if it won't, I have actually some crazy experience with that, having lilac, tree form lilacs that overwintered outside in their pots and pulled them into the greenhouse in probably January, maybe the end of December, but they had already gone through some pretty tough weather.
Yeah.
Pulled them into the greenhouse where they were ignored for a while. And then they started leafing out, and then they started flowering. And I thought, well, that's really fabulous.
Yeah.
And then, and then they got planted out and they lived. I'll tell you what really is funny about lilacs, though, and maybe you can tell me if yours is doing this. Sometimes when flowering plants that are supposed to be outside bloom indoors, the flower color is wrong. For example, dragonwing begonia, instead of being red, it'll be a very pale pink inside. Purple lilac might be a white lilac inside. Roses will do that as well, where they're supposed to be pink or maybe a salmon-y color, and they bloom inside and they're white. Did you have that happen?
No, it's purple.
It really is purple.
No.
It's purple, but the blossoms are really, really tiny. And I'm not sure if that's just indigenous to the species, you know.
Well, it might be. The ever-blooming varieties are a little bit different. But what I would say is as soon as you can get out into the ground and you know where you want to put it, as soon as you can dig that hole, go ahead and plant it and get it outside.
Yep.
Okay, it'll survive.
The other thing is that I went out and canoodled a whole pile of spring coloring bulbs out of somebody that had a lot left over at the end of the season, and he didn't know the lifespan, and I said, you can't just leave those in the store until spring and hope somebody buys them, they'll die. So I explained this all to him, and so I got a whole pile for real cheap. Now, this was a plot that I had because I was going to take a chance on whether or not this was going to happen. So I live in the Central Fans, and we don't have any dirt here. There's no dirt here, none, zero zilch, no worms, no bugs, no dirt, no nothing. So I dug trenches in my yard, and I went and bought a whole ton of frozen compost, and I put it in my front room and let it thaw it out. And then I went out and I planted bulbs, and I started this in December. Well, I still have a whole pile of bulbs left over, so I thought, well, what can I do with them? I'm building kind of raised beds with some lumber that I have, thinking that in spring I can always put some nice edging in there. But I'm going to just put the compost in heaps on top of the ground.
Oh, sure.
And just put the rest of the bulbs in there and see what happens.
They will be so happy.
They're going to really like you, Chris.
They will, you know, and you might not get 100% success, but if the bulbs have any firmness left to them, I mean, if they're not all wrinkled up and shriveled and all that, I think they're going to be really happy in that compost situation.
Oh, yeah.
So
I think you're
good for you. You are so my type of gardener. That's just great.
Thank you, Chris. Thanks so much for calling. Well, Eric in Edgerton has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Eric.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go right ahead.
Great. I am so glad to be calling in. I've been loving your show for a couple of years now. I'm calling with a question to try to help my parents out down in Lincoln, Illinois, central Illinois, with something that we kind of discovered together. Late this summer, I was down there helping them with pruning shrubs, working in their vegetable garden, and they had this infestation of these I don't know, like gnat-like bugs, very tiny but white. And you can't see them on the leaves until, for example, you know,
touch the plant, and then all of a sudden you have a cloud of little white things flying around you.
Exactly, exactly.
Yes.
Right. So we're just wondering, like, is there something that can be done over winter, like a soil pretreatment or some other kind of treatment to prevent them from popping up?
It sounds like what you have are white flies. And, you know, I have discussed this on more than one occasion with PJ Leash, who's our entomologist here at UW-Madison. And he says they don't overwinter. And I said, come to my house, because they do. And I have them in certain areas of my yard, and I can't quite figure out why and where they're coming from. And with me, they were showing up mostly on my containerized, like, tomato plants and in my herb garden area up against my house. But I figured the eggs must have been overwintering somehow, because it was a more protected location. Chances are that they will not overwinter, and that you won't have that problem in the spring. But there's nothing you can do about it now. What I would say is wait until spring, early summer, and if you start to see them again, there are a lot of different ways that you can treat for them. Some of them are more heavy into the pesticides than others. But it really helps if you can figure out where they're nesting, so to speak, where their origin is, and take care of them that way. When we're dealing with them, like in a greenhouse situation, it's one of the worst things to try to deal with, because they're very insecticide resistant. But those that are outside, they might be able to be contained just by using something like an insecticidal soap spray. But you really have to determine where they are and where they're laying their eggs, and, you know, and learn a little bit more about their life cycle. So they do lay eggs on the plants themselves, and technically they should not overwinter outside. So you shouldn't have a problem with them next year. But if you do, I would say call back when PJ's on the show.
Southern Illinois. Or you can just go to the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, shoot them an email.
And you could send them an email and ask him about it. But even in Southern Illinois, I don't think they should overwinter.
Yeah. Here you go, Eric. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Patty Nagai, retired UW Extension Horticulture Educator, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Patty Nagai. Great to have her back after about 4 years, I think. And so much fun talking with her today about your garden. We're kind of talking about midwinter gardening, but we're getting all kinds of questions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And I do want to take an email here. Jade emailed to ask when she should order the seeds and plants from catalogs for spring planting.
Well, ordering can happen just about any time. And you can even specify with most places when you want to receive the seeds. Plants, there's definitely a window in which they should be shipped, and definitely one where that window should be closed shut, because shipping plants in midwinter when the temperatures are below, you know, 20 degrees is probably not a great idea. But most companies know that, and they watch it, and they will ship the plants when it's time for the plants to be shipped to your zone. So they're really good about that. You can order seeds anytime. Anytime. And, you know, we were talking Garden Expo's coming up. You can go to Garden Expo and buy lots of seeds there.
Mm-hmm.
You can certainly start finding seeds in your local nurseries and garden centers. So there are a lot of places where you can get seeds.
And I do want to, as long as you mentioned Garden Expo, I want to put in a plug. I'll be there on Saturday morning of Garden Talk, which is the 8th of February. And the Garden Expo itself, I think, is Friday afternoon, Saturday, and Sunday. But I'll be
Sunday, they're having a big farmer's market.
Yeah, big farmer's market on Sunday. Saturday morning at 9:30, I will be on one of the stages with Dr. Death, Brian Huddleston.
And one of my favorite people.
And Lisa Johnson. And,
yeah,
and
great.
We've got one of the big, I think it holds around 400 people. And right. I always do some giveaways,
yes.
give away some books and so
forth.
If
you're going to go to that talk, you better get there early and wait by the door because it always fills up.
It's a lot of fun. It really is a lot of fun. Yeah. So I hope you make it to Garden Expo. And I hope Kathleen and Delavan is still with us. Kathleen, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes. Hi, good morning. I just wanted to remind people, if they don't want the aggressive common milkweed, there are two other varieties readily available through Agricol, Prairie Nursery, and even mm-hmm. some of the garden centers, which is swamp milkweed mm-hmm. and butterfly weed.
Right.
And the only thing people have to be careful of if they're getting them from the garden center is if they use the neonics in
right.
raising them. So, but they're so garden friendly and they're beautiful and they're
right.
perfectly good. And actually, I think the butterflies love the swamp milkweed better than the common if they have it.
Well, swamp milkweed is a really nice alternative, and there are there are actually even cultivars of that one if you're into more horticultural sort of characteristics. But just the plain Asclepias tuberosa, the butterfly weed, the native butterfly weed is so beautiful and really is an attractive plant in your yard. And there are butterflies, of course, that will feed on that, not just on the nectar. That's a great nectar plant, but there are a lot of butterflies that's a preferred food source for their eggs and larvae. You know, you'll see a lot of swallowtails on the mm-hmm. butterfly weed. So I'm glad you called, because that's a yeah. really good point, that there are a lot of other plants that you could include in your yard that are very, very butterfly friendly. And it's also important to remember, if you're into butterfly gardening, that the milkweeds can provide nectar, and then of course they're the food source for the larvae, which is super important. But there are also other plants that butterflies use
right.
as for nectar feeding, and for even things like planting grasses around your garden are helpful because they help buffer the wind and they give a nicer environment for your butterflies to feed in your garden. So there are a lot of ways that you can create a butterfly garden in your yard that can provide all stages of the butterfly's life cycle some happy place to be.
Yeah. Thank you, Kathleen.
Yeah,
just on that, on that same note, Julie in Hollister emailed. She's had good luck winter sowing milk seed and other natives. She stores them in the fridge until she sows, similar to what you had mm-hmm. said, except she creates a little greenhouse with a gallon jug. She puts a few on the bottom of the jug. Mm-hmm. And
so
one,
you have drainage.
And then 1 inch above the bottom mm-hmm. and no top on the jug. And she says there are some directions for that on YouTube.
Yeah, so that would be a good thing, too. Good use of milk, gallon milk jugs.
Absolutely. Lou Ray in Rosendale, thank you for calling.
Hi.
Hi, what's on your mind?
I was wondering what wattage one should use for grow lights using just an LED bulb instead of the commercial so-called grow lights that are really expensive.
Right. Well, when it comes to the LEDs, you have to be really careful about which ones you buy for use with plants. And I'm not. I need my husband here. He's the engineer person who could explain all this wattage and mm-hmm. stuff. But what I'm more interested in is the actual wavelength that is emitted from the lights. And so I don't try to use just, you know,
plain bulbs,
hardware store LED light bulbs. I purchase mine over the internet from specialty companies, and they don't, it's not, and the ones that I use come in a big, it's like a tray lamp. And the reason that they're done that way is that they can put 100 LEDs in this container that each of them has a different wavelength. So it provides the full spectrum that you need for healthy plant growth. And so it's not just any LED bulb. It has to be the LEDs that are specific for plants that provide the right wavelength.
Grow lights.
Yeah, and they don't even call them...
They don't call them that anymore, do they?
They don't call them grow lights. They just call them LED plant lights or plant LED. Lights, yeah. You often see them advertised in areas where they're talking about starting seeds, because, of course, seed starting is where you generally need the highest amount of extra light to make sure that you get a nice sturdy seedling.
And what's the and you don't remember where you get those trays of lights from?
I've bought them from two different sources, and no, I cannot tell you the brand name.
If you do a search
but
online.
But I tell you that if you search it online, they will pop up and they will say, Amazon will be happy to ship these to you in 2 days with your Prime membership. And the price on them has really come down. They are not as expensive as they used to be. When I first started doing this, I think the first one I bought was about $80. And then I bought one just last year, and I think it was only, I got two of them for $40.
Oh,
and they're maybe 13 by 13 inches.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you, Lou Ray. Appreciate it. Let's go to Jane in Eau Claire next. Hi, Jane.
Hi. I have a question. You were talking about losing perennials that were planted just last year because of the kind of warm weather we're having this winter. And I have a whole bed on the south side of my house, and they're kind of foundation plantings. They're fairly close to the house. We lost some bushes out there. We replaced them with sedum, spirea, and ornamental grasses. Mm-hmm. And when you were talking about, you know, winter mulch and things, I thought I'd go out and look at those and see how much snow was on them. We got pretty good snow cover up here, but we're having all this warm weather.
Yeah.
And actually, they're not completely covered in the front. It's deep, and then it goes right down to the dirt up by the foundation.
Right.
And I poked around in that dirt, and it's not frozen at all. Yeah. Am I likely to lose those?
No, I think you're okay. You know, when we talk about foundation plantings, it's a little bit different scenario because first of all, you really don't want to pile mulch up against your house. That's not a good scenario for your house. And with your regular mulch, you know, you don't want it piled up right against the base of the plant, the stem. So you're talking about mulch that completely covers the root system. And if you've got that mulch around the plant root system itself, it's okay that it's like that up against your house. It's not going to hurt anything. Chances are any roots that are over in that area, they're just going to be subjected to those temperature fluctuations. But you may not get the extreme temperature fluctuations there anyway, because your house is like this huge buffer to the world. That's why a lot of times when you plant things really close to your house, you can even skip a zone. Like if you're zone 5, there are some times where you can get away with planting a zone 6 plant if you planted it, you know, close enough to your house in a more protected area. Spirea, I wouldn't worry about. Even a newly planted spirea, they are just so amazingly tough. I would worry more about rodent damage on those because the rodents will go for the base of those plants. So make sure the mulch is not around the base of the plant. Ornamental grasses, I normally don't have issues with the grasses. Sometimes with some of the oats or the ornamental oats or the bluegrass, you can get a little bit of frost heaving. So that first year it might be important to have a winter mulch on them. And then the other one was sedum. Sedum are usually not an issue either. So I think with your plant material that you've selected for that area, I think you're going to be okay.
And Jane, thank you so much for calling. As you were talking, I was thinking about a plant I put in about 8-9 years ago, right on the sort of the corner where the house and the porch meet. Porch is not heated underneath, but the house is. And that plant is not a plant that is supposed to live in Wisconsin winter. You're supposed to dig it up. I didn't dig it up. And I thought, well, I'll just plant something else there next year.
And it came back.
8 years later, it's still there. I mean, it is having no trouble at all.
Right.
And it stays nice and green and cactus-like all winter long.
Yeah.
It's just amazing. Peggy called, by the way, to say that plant lights, you can get those plant lights at most hardware stores these days and even the big box stores.
Well, they have some plant lights. I know last year when I was looking, I haven't looked this year, I would expect that they would start selling more of those kind of lights in the stores. If you can find them locally, go ahead and get them. Just, you know, you want to look for the LEDs that are specifically designed for plants, though. That's the only thing.
Should say plant.
It should say that it's the proper wavelength for plants.
We're on the same wavelength.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness me. Our guest today, Patty Nagai. Patty is a emeritus professor and retired UW Extension horticulture educator. And we haven't had her on for about 4 years because she retired, but here she's never really retired. She's just kept working. And I hope we'll have a chance always to have her with us for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mealer. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mealer and really happy to have back Patty Nagai, emeritus professor, retired UW Extension horticulture educator, as we talk with her about gardening in the midwinter and taking all kinds of questions, actually, as we move through. You have a question about a plant or your garden? I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And we've got open lines so we can get you on pretty quickly. 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. You know, Martha emailed that she likes to start some annuals from seed. Last year, they sprouted and started out fine, but then many of them petered out. She thinks she overwatered them. Is it best to water only from the bottom or to spray them from above or some combination? She never knows how much water she needs to apply.
Well, overwatering seeds is a truly deadly thing. It's sad when that happens. And usually when you plant your seeds and you water them, they generally have enough moisture in that first watering to go through the entire germination process when you're talking about doing it inside. But of course, if the soil dries out before they're fully germinated, they will die. So you have to watch it pretty carefully. The bigger issue once they sprout, though, is it's not just the watering. It's the humidity. It's the light. It's all of those things. So I water my seeds from the top, my seedlings from the top, and let them drain completely. But I also set up a fan. I have a little fan that I clip to the side of my little seed starting place. Mm-hmm. And the fan oscillates and it blows across the seedlings, because what typically happens if you don't have good air movement is that you get a fungal disease called damping off.
Yeah.
And when she says that her seedlings petered out, I'm like, did they collapse and fall over? Because that's a real good indication that that disease, and it affects the stem. So your goal in starting seeds is to get them to germinate, and that's always a success, and we should applaud ourselves when that happens and we get little plants. But then to get them to grow into really strong seedlings. And the way to do that is to make sure that they have enough light, because light stimulates that girth growth.
Yeah.
It keeps them shorter and sturdier. Add a fan to keep good air movement to keep those fungal diseases at bay. And then if you really want to go after it and make the strongest seedlings possible, every morning, and you can do it as many times a day as you want, you should brush your seedlings.
Yeah.
So with your hand, your arm, a stick, whatever, very gently brush over the top of the seedlings and physically move them.
Yeah.
Because we know that that stimulates a whole slew of changes within the plant. It is a called a touch response. And it causes the cell walls to be thicker. It stops the vertical growth and increases the width of the plants. And so you end up with short, sturdy plants that are better able to resist those kinds of fungal diseases like damping off. So movement, light, touching, all of those things are as important as making sure that you water them correctly. You can water from the bottom. One of the problems that I have with watering from the bottom is that sometimes when people do that, they put too much water in there.
Yeah.
And then they don't realize that the trays are sitting in, you know, that your seedlings are sitting in water. And you never want your plants sitting in water.
No.
Because it does not take long for those little root rot organisms to work their way into your nice, healthy little seedlings.
So, yeah. And that touching is...
It's really important.
I can remember somebody calling in and said every time she walks by her host plants, she just runs her hand over them and just keeps going.
It feels good.
And just keeps going.
And, you know, and it sounds really silly. And, you know, I know back in the 70s, people used to talk about talking to your plants and touching your plants. And everybody went, oh, yeah, right. Like, that's really going to help. But now we have research to show that it really does help.
So there.
So there. We knew what we were doing back in the old days.
Jim in Plainfield, let's go to you now. Hi, Jim.
Hi. So I'm actually from up in the Tomahawk area. I just happen to be on the road. But I embraced the Elliot Coleman method of doing plantings through the winter.
Mm-hmm.
What I'd like to do is put one hoop house inside of another hoop house.
Okay.
And then use the row covers under that. But I'm wondering if you have any experience on that or... because I think I want to minimize my effort, you know.
Right.
So I figured a hoop house inside of a hoop house would just be two houses, and I wouldn't have to mess with some of the other stuff. Maybe, you know.
Yeah, you know, and that's a completely viable thing. I don't have a lot of experience with that particular type of growing, and I know that there are a lot of people in UW Extension who do a lot of that kind of growing. So there are actually publications available online that talk about the various ways that you can use hoop houses for long season or even winter season growing. So I would direct you there. But I just want to say that your idea of a hoop house within a hoop house makes sense because you've got that big volume of air between the two layers of plastic, which is essentially what growers do when they have air. They'll have a double layer of plastic on a hoop house, and then they set up a fan so that the two layers of plastic are separated by this volume of air from the fan actually blowing in there. So it's like you've got a balloon around your hoop house. But if you're setting up a hoop house in an area where you don't have electricity and you couldn't do that double layer method, then actually putting up a second structure gives you that air layer. But at some point you have to calculate out what the cost of that is and whether or not that is the best use of your funds as far as really creating the best growing system. But I would send you to publications and to your local extension agent because I know that there are people within the state who are doing that kind of work right now.
Yeah, especially there. If you go to the UW Learning Store, you can online.
You can just search for hoop house growing and you'll come up with a whole bunch of things.
It'll pop up. It'll pop up for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
And your extension person in that area for sure will know about
it. Call your local extension agent and help. You have them help you search for those materials if you can't find them.
And thanks again, Jim.
Yeah, great question.
Yeah, Beth in Woodruff. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Great, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I put in two cold frames this year and in Woodruff, Wisconsin, and I have not been able to get good instructions about how to treat the plants inside. So I've had people tell me, you know, horticulturalists, well, just water them like heck and close them for the winter and various other things.
Right.
So
that's what a lot of people do.
What I've tried to do is act like snow.
Yeah.
If the snow is melting, Usually the cold frames can be opened.
Mm-hmm.
And then I take my Haws fine watering can with a little tiny seedling spray,
uh-huh.
and I give them a little water. I don't know if this is right or it's not. I have bellwort, I have rosemary, I have primroses, I have Nordic strawberries, and the Nordic strawberries, a lot of the foliage is bronzing off, but mm-hmm. not all of it.
Right.
And I don't know if I'm doing well or I'm not. What should I do?
Well, one of my questions was going to be, what are you trying to grow in there? And of the ones that you mentioned, the only one that really stands out to me is potentially not going to work would be the rosemary. The rest of them should be fine in there. There's a grower in my area who does all of his perennials in cold frames and has great success doing it that way. And it really is an ignore kind of a thing.
Yeah. It's the beauty of it.
That is the beauty of it. In fact, he covers some of them with straw to give them an extra layer of protection. But basically what you're doing is sinking them into the ground because the cold frame, you know, should be underneath the soil line. And so you've got that natural buffering capacity of the soil. And as long as we've got snow cover, you know, the temperature in there should be way warmer than what we have outside. Plus, it should stay fairly constant if you've got a nice cover on top of it. So I think you're doing the right thing. As far as watering, you water in the fall when, you know, you set the cold frames up and you put those plants in there. But then you shouldn't have to water again until we start seeing some serious sunlight and some warmer temperatures.
Yeah.
So I think the biggest mistake that people make with cold frames is actually forgetting that they can get hot really fast if they mm-hmm. don't get vented on days when we have a lot of sun and warm weather, which is hard to think about right now, but it will come.
Yeah.
It'll happen.
It'll happen.
Does that help at all, Beth?
It does. I forgot to tell you, though, that my cold frames are not in the ground.
Oh, they're not?
No, because my property manager doesn't want things.
Oh.
So they're set on top of the ground. They have landscape cloth liners and then 6 inches of soil.
What are you using for the sidewalls?
It's the whole thing. The cold frame is a whole box without a bottom.
So it's wood. It's wood. It's not concrete block.
I'm sorry. No, they're double. They're 8 millimeter double polycarbonate.
Oh.
And they seem to stay warm. I put some violas that I had that I really liked.
Right.
In the fall, I put them in and they're still in bloom. They're not blooming, but they're still in bloom.
And you have 6 inches of soil as a buffer around the, is that what you?
Or the pot sunk down into the soil.
No, that's in the landscape cloth. And I'm letting the snow come partway up the side.
Okay.
And I'm
Are they covered?
Some snow be on top. Of,
Do you have a cover on it?
There's a. Yep, it's a locking cover. It has indigo screens.
I got it.
For the summer. That way I can open.
Right. Okay. I understand what you're saying. So you still have a buffer there. It's not quite the same and not as much of a buffering as you would if you had it sunk down into the ground. But for that kind of a situation, it's more like a raised bed.
Yeah.
But it might be just trial and error. But I wouldn't worry so much about the watering of them right now because they should not be using a lot of water. There should not be a real need for... If they were watered thoroughly when you put them in there, they're probably okay.
Yeah. There you go, Beth.
Okay.
But let us know. I'm very curious now, Beth, about how this is going to work for you this year. So I want you to call back
in the spring and
tell us about your success. I'm very curious about the rosemary and whether or not you have success with that.
Yeah, especially rosemary.
Yeah. Rosemary is just tough, and the only reason they're in there is because when I went to take my raised beds off the driveway so we could plow this winter, there were a couple I didn't know were there.
They were still alive. So they're survivors.
Yeah, they are. Beth, thank you so much. Appreciate your call. Oh, my goodness. Dennis and Phillips, your turn.
I got a question. I have a hibiscus tree, and I get in every year. everybody said just let it die and then go get another one. Well, this one I've had for like 6 years. How I really should care for it, because some years it go good and some years it don't.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of people do. I'm proud of you for taking care of it and bringing it in. That's good.
For 6 years.
I do that too. I have two. I have a shrub form and a tree form that I've had for probably 10 years that I just take them out and bring them back in. But I also understand the other side of it, you know, where you should just let them die. Go buy another one. Support your local green industry by buying more plants. Yes, that's what I should be telling you. But, you know, hibiscus, much like citrus, they do really great in this in-and-out thing where you put them outside in the summer and you bring them back out in the winter, bring them back inside in the winter. And much like citrus, they are also pretty heavy feeders and they require a lot of care. And so they do require fertilization on a regular basis. And this is another plant that I fertilize all year long. You know, house plants, sometimes we stop fertilizing them over the winter when the light levels are lower and the days are shorter and temperatures are cooler and all of those things, and they're not growing very much. But hibiscus and citrus continue to grow, and they grow vigorously all year long, and they continue to flower. And so whenever you have a plant that's still putting out foliage and it's still flowering, fertilization is really critical. And so when you bring your hibiscus in, you might find that it drops foliage. It might drop some flower buds, and that's an adaptation to your interior environment. But it will make new leaves. The leaves that it makes, this is one of those plants that makes sun leaves and shade leaves.
Yeah.
And so the leaves that it makes outside are a little bit physiologically and morphologically different than leaves that it makes when it comes back inside. And so you need to be providing those nutrients, water, and light so that it can continue to grow and thrive once it's inside. The other thing I do with my hibiscus in the winter, I do not cut them back initially because I find that they continue to flower. In fact, mine are still flowering now.
Good
I have
for you.
A yellow one and a red one, and I still have a few buds coming on those, so I haven't cut them back yet. But sometime in February is usually when I take them and do a pretty serious pruning on them because I don't want them to get so big that I can't take them in and out. You know, I want them to do that. And then when you prune them earlier in the spring and then you maybe switch over to a fertilizer that promotes flower buds, make sure they're getting enough light, make sure that they don't dehydrate and wilt. By the time you put them out in the spring again, you should be setting yourself up for a nice flush of flowers once you get them outside.
And when you prune, tell us about your process. I mean, where do you make your cuts and that sort of thing?
Well, with the hibiscus tend to be a little bit squirrely and messy in their growth habit. And I don't like that, so I cut out the branches that offend me. I just cut them
just
off.
Take them out.
Take them off all the way down to the base. But my goal, actually, is to produce more branches.
Yeah.
And I like it when the branches come with the shrub form. I like it when they come from the bottom. I want lots and lots of branches because the more branches you have, the more flowers you have. With the tree form, I make sure that I cut all those branches off that are trying to grow from the trunk because I don't want branches down there. I only want a nice ball of branches at the top that will produce a lot of flowers. But I follow the same pruning rules I do for trees. You know, I make the cuts at a node or I cut them all the way back to the trunk. I make sure that the node is facing up or out so that when that bud breaks, the branch isn't growing towards the center of the plant or crossing another.
Yeah.
I like the branches to grow up and out in a real nice, orderly fashion because I'm just that kind of person.
You're an orderly kind of gal.
So you follow the same rules. You know,
yeah.
you cut back branches that are dead. You cut back branches that are crossing. You cut branches off that are growing towards the center of the plant.
And there you have it, Dennis. Thank you so much.
Pruning,
appreciate it.
Pruning 101.
Josh in Mazomani. Hi, Josh.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So my wife started an avocado tree from an avocado seed or pit about 5 or 6 years ago. It's up about 9 feet tall. It's a real skinny stalk that goes up with big, beautiful leaves.
Yeah.
Now, in the past, in the winter, they would kind of fall off.
Right.
But this year, they're turning brown. And then falling off, which they hadn't done in the past. So I'm just curious, is there something we can do to help this beautiful plant of ours?
Oh, well, it's It's not dead, so that's good. That's a good thing. Avocado trees are actually pretty darn tough. Of course, it's Wisconsin, not Florida or California or southern Texas, so our humidity is going to do a number on them. So there's some things that you can try. You can make sure that you're keeping it well watered and you're not letting it dry out, because, of course, drying out can cause those leaves to brown and fall off. Likewise, overwatering it can cause that same thing. So sometimes when you have browning and leaf drop, it's an indication that there's a root issue. If it continues and you're not getting a lot of new growth, or the new growth doesn't look right and it just looks like it's really unhealthy, I would suggest that you take it out of the pot and look at the roots and make sure that you don't have any root rot going on, or that you don't have some issues that can be addressed by repotting, pruning the roots, repotting it into some nice clean potting soil, and, you know, starting over with some good watering habits. The other thing you might want to check for, sometimes avocados do get spider mites, and that can cause the leaves to brown and drop off. So if you've ever had spider mites, when you get to a really serious infestation, you'll actually see the silky webbing on the bottoms of the leaves, or in the axils of where the petiole meets the trunk, or where the leaf blade meets the petiole. You'll see some nice little webbing. If you see the webbing, that means you've got millions of spider mites. So spider mites are not insects. They are arachnids. And so a lot of the insecticides don't work on spider mites. But one of the things that I have found that works the best on spider mites and houseplants is to wash the plants off on a regular basis. Now, a 9-foot avocado is a little bit more challenging. Yeah. But you said it's skinny, so that doesn't surprise me either. Put it in the shower and wash it off, and that'll take care of the spider mites. But you do have to do it on a regular basis to keep the population down. The other thing that you can do to help your plant, once you get this figured out, is I would suggest that you start pruning it, because avocados will grow really, really tall and not shoot out those side branches unless you force it. And the way you force a tree to shoot out side branches like an avocado is to tip prune it from the top.
Yeah.
So you got to prune it so that you can force those side branches to come out.
If you don't have many side branches,
have a house that's, you know, 20-foot ceilings, floor-to-ceiling windows, and you can have a 20-foot avocado tree.
Yeah, my last house had a 20-foot.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you have a 20-foot avocado tree?
No, I had a cactus, though, that went up about 15.
Wow.
It was something
really tall. That's a really big cactus.
Yeah, and it was...
Did it ever fall over? Because that's what I'd be worried about.
broke once, and I just set the broken piece aside, let it dry out for a couple of weeks, and stuck it back in some soil, and then it grew. There you go.
The beautiful thing about cacti and succulents. Yes, absolutely.
Patty, it is such a great pleasure. Will you come back and be with us again?
I'd be happy to. Oh. All you have to do is ask, Larry. You just didn't ask.
We will be asking. Patty Nagai, our emeritus professor and retired UW Extension horticulture educator, will be back with us again, and we will talk with her again. Next week, Dr. Death Brian Huddleston with us. So we'll look forward to that as well.
I have to listen in. Maybe I'll call.
Maybe you will. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.